Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
With Dale, motherfucking Comstock, American Badass, Volume 4. And Dale always seems to tell me the best stories when I'm not allowed to record. So maybe I didn't record it. The NSA will have some good episodes, but not you, the editor.
Right? So,
yeah, no, really, no shit. They have the good episodes. You want the unedited episodes? Go buy your NSA membership. They'll give you everything. They'll even give you the videos of me on my phone shitting, like, don't even know I'm being recorded. This podcast is already going off the rails, so Dale Comstock, back in the saddle. Everybody knows him. No need for introduction, but I'll do it anyway. Author of American Badass. And we've been going over every Sunday a different chapter or a different section. And today we're doing Volume 4 of American Badass. And we might just go on forever doing these volumes, so don't look for an ending. But Dale, coming live from Paradise, Bali. It's all yours, Dale.
Yeah, man. Okay, so thanks for having me on. And everybody that's out there listening, I'm not going to go through my background history. If you don't know who I am, go to episode one, and we talked quite a bit about that, so you'll know who I am. Try not to waste too much time on me, more so on the stories, right? So we decided to decided that it'd be cool if I could tell my stories about my book in my own words. And so that's actually what we're doing. So today we're, I think, on episode four, and we have quite a ways to go just through the American Badass book. And then down the road, as Tom just alluded to, this could go on for quite some time because I'm actually writing another book, which picks up where I left off in 2011. My military career and my Hollywood stints and stuff like that, and everything I've done since that time to the present time, which is quite a bit and quite unique. And I think you'll definitely enjoy those stories.
Yeah.
So what I want to do today is I want to pick up where I kind of left off last week. I talked about my time in the 82nd Airborne Division. That was actually where I started out in my military career. I ended up initially in the 2nd 325th Airborne Infantry, and then my platoon was selected to become the 82nd Airborne Division Work Platoon, which was we started the LERP program from Vietnam. It was, you know, they stopped it and then they wanted to resurrect it back in 1982 timeframe. Yeah, 82. And so that's where I ended up, 82nd LERPs. So with all that said, I'm going to kind of pick up talk a little bit about my experience in the 82nd LERP division, right? So last time we talked, I mentioned that I was coming up on my 4-year ETS date, right? End of my enlistment, right? And I had a choice, either reenlist or get out. And be honest with you, I wasn't really happy with being in the military anymore. Being an infantryman, digging holes just to fill them up and sitting under a tree for 3 days straight, cleaning your M16, just wasn't very challenging. So, you know, I was at a crossroad. I did want to go to Special Forces, but I didn't know if I wanted just to do the time and the hard work to get it. And I felt like I missed the civilian world. I was married. I had a daughter at the time, very small. And as I mentioned last time, my mom's the one that pretty much put the kibosh on the whole idea of getting out. When I called her, I said, "Hey, Mom, I'm thinking about getting out. You know, my ETS day's coming up. And would you mind if my wife and my daughter come and live with you for a few months till I get on my feet, you know?" And I still remember, man, she was like, "No, not no, but hell no, you're not coming home." And I'm like, shit, man. So I thought, man, my mom loved me. But so she made a decision for me. And I realized that I'm on my own. And then all these other things started happening, right? So I got the letter to go to Delta Force selection. I went through all that and I made it to the assessment selection program and ended up in OTC, which I'll talk about here in a minute. But first I want to talk about the 82nd Airborne Division. So, not sure if I really mentioned it last time. It's all kind of running together. But my experience as a LERP, in the 82nd was pretty cool. And we worked in 4 to 5-man teams. You know, we are as a long-range reconnaissance, patrolman. You know, our job was to go during the Cold War to go behind enemy lines up to 120 kilometers, right? Anyway, we inserted anyway and by any means, right? Whether it was by foot, boat, helicopters, parachute. But our job was to get behind enemy lines, hunker down, and then report back to friendly lines and tell them what's going on with the enemy activity, especially on the backside of their, what they call a FEBA, right? The forward edge of the battle area. So, you know, LERPs have quite a history, especially in Vietnam. And I think, Tommy, you're going to have, you know, basically my military mentor on your show here not too long from now, who was a LERP in the in Vietnam, and he's got some amazing stories. And when I met the guy initially, roughly around 1982, out the Special Forces Air Course in Camp McCall, I realized that Gary O'Neill, this guy is going to be my military mentor, man. He's an amazing dude, man. He's cool. And so anyways, so my time in 82nd, you know, it was interesting. And I remember a couple of things happened to me, right? So I'm going to try to compress all this into one hour. So I got a lot to tell. So listen closely. So a lot of weird things were happening back then. One of the weird things that happened, and I'm going to bring this up because it's important to note this, I think. You know, when we talk about, you know, so we got the new, you know, this new guy in that calls himself the president of the United States. You know, he's not my president, and I don't mind saying that. It sounds kind of, you know, cliche, but, you know, he and I don't share the same values, not even close. But anyways, you know, now he's, you know, said basically transgenders can come back in the military and, you know, you can parade around and do transgender things and, you know, and to hell with everybody else. So, and the reason that's unsettling for me is because I had a very bad experience with something like this. It's very close to that, and I'll explain that here in a second. As I'm thinking about this, what happened was about two and a half years ago, and this will be another story later on, but I was working as a bodyguard in Los Angeles for a very rich 31-year-old millionaireess. It was amazing, right? She fell in love with me. It was like a story, right? Like a movie. It's going to be a movie. But her friends were all super liberal, right? And they just couldn't get their head around the idea that why are we keeping transsexuals and, you know, all these other trans things and, you know, fucking, you know, homosexuals out of the military, combat arms and infantry and blah, blah, blah. She goes, everybody should be allowed to, you know, experience that and do that and be that, right? And what they don't understand was, and I try to explain it to them, was unless you've been there, you know, you really don't have an opinion. Yeah. It would be like me telling a brain surgeon how to do brain surgery with no knowledge about brain surgery other than if you got a headache, you know, try an aspirin. So I have no credibility whatsoever to weigh in on that topic, right? I might shut the fuck up and sit down.
Yeah.
And basically that's what they're telling me, you know? And I'm like, you know, you guys have never been in the military, right? Let alone, for example, the infantry. And so you really have no opinion that matters until you really understand the dynamics of the military. You got no opinion. And that goes for anybody out there. You have no opinion of any value. You know, you can have your opinion, but it means shit, yeah. Right? And so I'm getting this earful from these. I mean, and these were billionaires and millionaires, right? Blah, 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 blah. You know, rich chicks, you know, and
yeah,
freaking androgynous dudes, you know, telling me, you know, all this bullshit, you know, about, you know, how the military should be. And they themselves never spent a day. Probably never got in a street fight, you know, on a playground or anything. So I remember I thought about it and I told them a story, right? So basically, and so I'm going to save that part of the story for later on when we go into the other book. It's pretty funny, the whole story with these liberals, man. It blew their mind. I literally had them getting up and leaving because they're like, oh, my God. Oh, my God, I can't stay here and listen anymore. This
is blasphemy. Who is this man? Who is this straight white man?
It was funnier than shit, man. But so what happened was this. It is one story, right? I just want to kind of expand just for a second. So we had this guy. So we, you know, we're a platoon of infantry guys. You know, we're pretty tight knit. You know, we feel kind of elite and special because we're the LERPs of the 82nd Airborne Division. You know, we're the eyes and ears of 15,000 paratroopers. And, you know, we were proud of that. And the reason we were the LERPs because our platoon was selected out of all the infantry companies in the 82nd to be the Lurps because of our record. We had won many what they call RTEPs, which is a basically field evaluations, right? And you scored on and blah, 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 performance. And we were like the champions. And so we became the Lurps. So we were pretty good. And which was kind of weird because when you looked at back, going back in that time, right, 1981, 82, 83, in the 82nd Airborne Division, they call us the Jumping Junkies for a reason, right? And so, and it's because everybody was stoned, man. You know, my whole platoon was always stoned except for three guys, actually four guys. Me, my two best friends that joined the Army with me, Joe and Putt, and they're still my best friends to this day. They're like my brothers. And then the platoon sergeant, Sergeant First Class Wilson, who was basically, he looked like Tom Berenger from Platoon, man. Looked just like him. And he was a Vietnam vet from Americal, you know, and he just had that freaking, everything about him said Tom Berenger, yeah, man. And, you know, and I've never forgot this guy. And he's taught me some, you know, some great lessons that I've never forgotten. I still apply today. But we were really the only four, Lieutenant Sinigan, he was a platoon leader, young Butterbar lieutenant, you know, you know, he tried really hard, but he was squared away. So, okay, five of us didn't smoke any dope. Everybody else was fucked up. I tell you what, it was funnier than shit. If you walk down the base of the building of the 82nd Airborne Division, take any barracks you want. If you look, walk around the base, there were marijuana plants growing from all the seeds that were getting pushed out the windowsills, and it was growing on the bottom. It was that kind of weird shit, right? And so, hey, you know, whatever, right? But we were badass, right? We might have been stoned, or they might have been stoned, but, you know, we were pretty badass. Yeah. And so what happened was we were assigned to the 313th Military Intelligence Battalion as the Lurps, right? Which is kind of weird. And the reason it's kind of weird, it was weird for us because all the other platoon, they were called RIMS, RIMBAT, RIMS, Remote Sensors. So these were guys that would go out and also in the woods, you know, on the Ford Edge Valley, they would, you know, plant sensors and radar systems, you know, in the field to detect, you know, the enemy coming across. And so they kind of lead to, I guess, you know, but they were in infantry. And every morning, my platoon at the company formation, we had to have a company formation for PT, and we all formed up as a company. The first sergeant would call the company in formation, you know, to attention. And my platoon, every time we snapped to attention, we would sound off with "Recon," right? Just like in the movies, right? And nobody else said anything. None of the other platoons didn't have that esprit de corps, right? They'd all look at us like, "Recon," you know, like whatever, right? And we were like, "Recon, yeah. Kick your ass,
retard."
So one day we get this guy, man, and you know, we were always getting new guys from time to time. This guy shows up. He's assigned to the Lurps. And we're like, "Where are you from?" You know? And actually, back in this time, this was 1983. It was a black guy, right? And not that that means anything, but he was out of the Ranger Battalion. And we thought, fuck, man, you know, you don't hear of a lot of black guys in the Ranger Battalion, right? Or any combat arms, especially back during that time. So he shows up, and right away we're all thinking, man, this guy has to be part freaking Corps, you know, the freaking Ranger, and, you know, you know, so anyways, so we accepted him right away, man. I was like, this is really cool. And we actually looked up to him. A lot of us did, like, wow, we really admire this guy, you know? And so I remember every day we would be running down the street in formation, and a lot of times we saw him running on his own, and he would have on his running shoes, no socks. He would have on the short little black, you know, we call them Ranger panties, right? We had these little black running shorts that did look like little panties, right? And booty shorts, right? In fact, my wife wears them all the time, and her ass cheeks are hanging out. It's pretty hot. and he would run, and he had no shirt on, and he wore a yellow scarf around his neck, a yellow scarf around his fucking neck. And he had a bald head, right? And we were like, okay, that's a little weird, but he's a Ranger, so it's cool. It must be cool. That's what they do, right? We just kind of accepted that, right? Didn't think much of it. And so one day, a few months later, I can't remember how long it was, I had a room with four guys in it, right, in my room. And, you know, we were allowed to kind of, like, adjust our rooms a little bit, you know, and we had our four beds. We set our wall lockers up, so the room was kind of compartment. It was a big room, you know, you know, we had a TV in there, and, you know, the four of us that went in there were like, cool, man, we're like brothers, you know, we enjoyed our time in our room. And so every weekend when the platoon would come out of the field, it was SOP to have a party in the barracks, right? Get drunk, you know, some guys would get high, but get drunk and sneak the hookers upstairs, you know, and just and just have a freaking blast, right? That's just what we did. It was like being in prison, right?
Yeah.
Because it was cheap. We didn't have the money to get in a cab and go downtown and chase pants, right? So we just did it all right there in the barracks, and it was more convenient. And so I remember this one particular time. I was in the primary, what they call it at the time, it was called PNOC, which is the primary non-commissioned officer's course. And it was for the junior NCOs, right? I just made E5 sergeant, and I had to go through this course, which is on Fort Bragg. And on this particular weekend, on Friday, we were released and said, look, you can go home for the weekend, but you have to be back Sunday. And like, cool, right? So I go home. And the platoon party's happening Saturday night, you know, everybody getting fucked up. Except me, I didn't drink, right? Actually, me and my two best friends, right, that joined the Army with me from Sacramento, Joe and Kenny, we weren't party types. We weren't drinkers, none. We just kind of like, okay, it was kind of cool. We, you know, we were more into fitness and just weren't that freaking rambunctious. But so I remember they were partying their ass off, right? And when they partied hard. They partied where, like, they would just beat the shit out of each other. They were best friends and beat the shit out of each other, you know. Just there was blood. There was, you know, bodies laying around the shower, you know, freaking. It was crazy, right? But and the next day, everybody was in love again, right? Yeah. Fucking go back out in the field and kick some ass. You know, and that's what made us who we were. But this one particular night, I remember I had to get up at 0500 and be back at PNOC. And one of the things we didn't do, most fucking just didn't do it, right? Is when we made our beds, right? We tightened our bedspreads in military style. We didn't want to screw up our beds, right? Because we didn't want to lay in them and have to make the bed every morning, right? Because there was an inspection, you know, we want to make sure our shit was right. So we all tended to sleep on top of our bed and our blankets, and we would just wrap up in a nylon poncho liner, right? Camouflage nylon poncho liner, which was great. They're like, you know, military whoopies, you know, whoopies. And, you know, that's what we carried the field with us. They were very warm. And so it's convenient, right? Just roll up in your little poncho liner and sleep on top of your bed, you know? And so, and mine had my initials in it, you know, and DAC. And this particular night, these guys are partying. And I'm like, man, you know, I got to go to school tomorrow. I don't have time for this. So, we go to bed. And we didn't lock rooms, the doors either, on none of the rooms, right? That was just, you didn't have to, right? It's like we trusted everybody. You know, all the doors were always unlocked. And it was kind of SOP anyways, the NCO, you know, the platoon sergeant said keep doors unlocked because they want to come in your room at any time and inspect, you know? So we did. And so I get up, you know, and I'm off to school at 0500 in the morning. And then, and here's what happens. So these guys get like totally wasted. And I remember there's this one guy, a little short dude, man. I can't remember his name. I think it was Zuschlag or something like that. Anyways, he goes to bed. He's drunk off his ass. He's, you know, he goes into a coma on his mattress. He's sound asleep. And he wakes up, and this is going to sound really bad, but this guy, this ranger, has got his underwear down his ankle, and he's giving him a blowjob while he's sleeping. And he wakes up and just loses his shit, right? And so it turns out this ranger guy was actually a homosexual. And he went in there and pulled this guy's doors down while he was asleep and took advantage of him while he was drunk. And he sucked his cock. And, well, that just turned into a fucking shitstorm, right? So, I mean, literally, they brought the MPs in. They got this guy out right away. I literally discharged him out of the military in 72 hours.
Well, that's, that's rape, right? That is rape.
Pretty much, right? And so, well, back, this was, remember, this is 1982, 83 time frame, right? So they didn't have all the policies now, you know, don't tell, don't ask, all this crap, you know, sure. And, you know, it was foreboding to be, you know, homosexual, et cetera, in the military. Well, all this happens, and I think nobody really knew how to deal with it, right? And so they got this guy out and literally discharged him in 72 hours. We never saw him again from the minute that happened.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I first started, everybody grabbed this guy by his freaking, you know, stack and swivel and took him out. But then that started, you know, the circus. So so then here's the weird thing that happened. I'm in school and they find my poncho liner with my initials. The guy apparently came into my room. Maybe he was looking for me. I don't know. But he grabbed my poncho liner and he went to the other guy's room to suck his cock. And he left my poncho liner in there, right? So we're like, where's this Comstock dude at? And I'm like, man, I'm in Pinock, man. I got witnesses. I didn't do none of that shit. And I swear to God, man. And so, you know, we're trying to put it all together. Well, maybe he came looking for you, Comstock. And I'm like, hey, I'm a sexy bitch.
Hey, don't hate on me. Don't hate on me, man, you know?
It was crazy, right? So, but then it only got worse after that, right? So now what happened was, everybody knew what happened in the battalion. And I remember, and so we're like, oh, my God, you know, and everybody's just trying to get their head around what just happened here, you know, and total disbelief. Well, I remember then we had our first formation, a company formation, and a company attacks, come on, right? And then, recon, right? Recon, and then everybody yells, recon, oh, recon. That shit started, recon. Right? And that was followed by fucking company size fist fights, dude. Man, we were out there, dude. It was crazy, right? And this happened for like a month. It was like relentless, nonstop. I mean, they just hazed us every day because of one guy, man. We caught so much shit for that, you know, as a platoon. There, you know, we're like, you know, oh yeah, all right, and we started going to blows, man, and it got so bad that finally the battalion commander, he took us across the street to a movie theater. You know, there's several movie theaters on, I think it was Ardennes Drive there on Fort Bragg, but basically got the whole battalion over and got up there, and he's like, look, he goes, here's the deal. He goes, right now you guys are combat effective. I couldn't take you monkeys to combat if I wanted to. I mean, you're out there beating each other up. You're calling each other, you know, recon and faggots and whatever else. He goes, you guys are duking it out. He goes, I'm going to start writing Article 15s. People are going to go to jail. If there's another fight, if there's any more harassment, any more hazing, you know, this is the end of the line, right? So it took him to do that to shut this whole thing down. And so my point to that story is one guy literally just completely disrupted an entire battalion. I mean, brought us to the point where we're literally beating the dog shit out of each other at every turn. It was just insane, right? And so it was like prison, man.
Well,
that's
an effective weapon, right? If you're the enemy, that's an effective weapon. One guy goes in and blows some other dude and you've taken out a whole battalion. That's an effective weapon.
Dude, and that's exactly what happened, right? So people, you know, everybody goes, hey, you know, fucking everybody should have an opportunity. They don't get it, man. They just don't get it. I've seen the same situation with women, okay? I've had women with me in the field. I've had to take them out in the field and do all this training and stuff. And, man, it never works out because men are men and women are women. And eventually nature takes over, man. That's just how it works, man. And I always hear women go, well, men need to keep their dick in their pants. I'm like, no, women need to keep their pants closed, you know? It goes both ways, man, you know? It goes both ways. Anyways, that was my little thing in the 82nd, just one of my little experiences. And later on, when I go into my other book story and I talk about, you know, my experience as a bodyguard in Los Angeles, I bring this story up again. It's actually kind of funny what happens there. But I did get the opportunity in the LERPS to go, you know, my first combat deployment was Grenada. In fact, I was in Pinock. So I was in Pinock still when this happened, right? Actually, at the time, it was Pinock Recondo School together, right? So on the back end of the non-commissioned officers course, you had to go to Recondo, which was 2 weeks long and on the field. And I don't even think they have Recondo anymore, but basically it's like a mini ranger school. And you go out there and you do ranger Recondo stuff. And we're out there and we're finishing up. And then one morning we're in a standing in the woods, oh dark dirty, fucking shivering and stuff because it was October and Fort Bragg. And we noticed all these fighter jets flying around. Well, we don't have fighter jets because Fort Bragg and Pope Air Force Base were together. But Pope Air Force Base provided, C-130, C-141s, transport aircraft for the paratroopers to jump out of. They didn't have a fighter wing there. But also we're noticing fighters flying overhead, right, doing circles. And then we're hearing all this aircraft going on. And it's like, what's going on, man? And then during his formation, all of a sudden, the first sergeant, he's the op sergeant major, whoever it was, I can't remember, was calling out names. He goes, okay, if you hear your name call, I need you to grab your shit and report back to your unit, right? And they're going down the list and calling everybody else going to the unit. And so finally, we're starting to figure out that there's something going on, like real world. And so I ended up back in the unit, and my platoon had already deployed. They were one of the first ones out, right? The eyes and ears for the unit. So they were the first one downrange already in Grenada. That was going on October 3rd, 1983. And so I show up, and I'm like, hey, where's everybody at? And I'm ready to go. And I'm like, oh, they already left. So there's no room for you. You don't need to worry about going. I'm like, what? I wanted to go, man. It's like, damn, freaking everybody went downrange. I want to go too, We'll hang around here in the barracks and what, mop floors. And so they figured out a way to get me down there. Basically, they put me on a C-141, and basically I had to escort a bunch of batteries for the other platoons, right? Their rims, their sensor systems, all the shit required these freaking batteries, right? And they needed to get their batteries down to them. Like, that's perfect. I said, I can ride batteries down there. So I did. And so I fly down on the C-141. I'm the only guy on this damn thing, right? With all these batteries and shit. And we land in Grenada. And I remember now, this is a combat zone. We got Cubans there. We got PRA there fighting it out with the Rangers in 82nd, And so I come in there, and the way it was set up, Salinas Airfield was a runway. It was basically an extended runway off the island. And so what would happen is the aircraft would learn. They would do what they call EROS engines running on stand. They wouldn't even shut the engines off. They'd drop the ramps and shit. They'd freaking dump everything out, raise the lamps, and freaking, take off again, right? They didn't want to be sitting on that runway and be subjected to mortar attacks and things like that. So the plane lands, right, pulls up to the ATOC, right, which is, the Tactical Operations Center, it's a tent, right, a small tent. And that's where the aircraft traffic controller is, and there's a first lieutenant out there, and he's the airfield commander. And we're unloading all this shit, right, on batteries and boxes and stuff, boom, 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 and the plane takes off, and I'm standing there, and nobody's waiting for me, right? I was told my guys would be waiting to pick me up, and they're not here. So I think, well, maybe they're late. So I sit on a freaking ammo box. I'm waiting. And it's getting dark. It's already kind of dark. It's, last light when the plane showed up. And it's starting to get dark. So I'm just sitting there waiting, where they at. And finally, his lieutenant comes up to me. He's like, hey, man. He goes, listen, I don't know where your unit's at. He goes, and I really don't care. He goes, but you can't stay here. I go, what do you mean I can't stay here? You can't stay here. You got to leave. You can't stay on the airfield. I'm the DCO or the airfield, commanding officer, ACO. And I'm like, whoa. I said, well, where the hell am I supposed to go? He goes, I don't know. He goes, just call. And I'm like, looking at him like, are you kidding me? I'm a Spec 4 at the time, right? And I just turned to E5. No, Spec 4 going to E5. And I'm young, man. I'm a kid, man. Yeah. I'm pretty young. I'm still, and so.
How old are you at this point?
At this point, this is 1983, so I was 81. I was 20 years old.
Okay.
Right, 20 years old. So I'm like, well, okay, can I have some ammunition, So they give me a couple of magazines of ammunition, and it's dark now. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, where the fuck am I going? I have no idea where I'm going. I have no idea. I don't know where I'm at.
They just kick you off.
Yeah, exactly. So I literally walk off into the dark, and I'm walking, just walking down the roads, and I'm like listening. Maybe I hear an American voice, nothing. Maybe I hear a Cuban voice, I don't know. Right? And so I'm walking. I'm walking for hours, man. And I walk all the way down to Georgetown, which is the capital. And I get right outside of Georgetown, and I'm thinking, man, it's probably not a good idea going to Georgetown because I don't know if we own it or they own it, right? And so I'm sitting there thinking, well, goddamn, what do I do? I'm by myself. I don't know where to go. You know, do I lay down until the sun comes up and everybody sees me? You know, I'm like freaking out here. I don't know what to do. So I walk back the opposite direction. I'm walking down this road for hours, right? And it's pitch black, and I'm, you know, jungle, trees on the side of the road. And I finally, as I'm walking along, I hear, "Halt, who goes there?" And when I heard that, I go, "Fuck." I go, "Sean?" And it was my guy on my team, Sean Pearson. And I go, "Sean? Dale?" Cop dog? And like in the middle of the darkness, we're hugging each other, like, "Oh my God," and I'm so happy, you know? I just happened to bump into him, and he was basically pulling security at the gate, which was, we were at the American ambassador's residence from the embassy. He had a villa that was, you know, right off on the edge of this like cliff facing the ocean. Really nice. But it wasn't there, right? We were occupying it. We were sleeping all over the place. And he just happened to be at the gate pulling security at that time, guard, you know, duty. And so I was so freaking happy, right? And I linked up with my platoon and team and team sergeant, platoon sergeant, and got oriented. I was like, "Oh, thank God, you know, I'm freaking in Grenada, you know?" And so I'm safe. But we did a couple missions. I did a few missions there. Probably the best one was on, I went to, we had a mission. So what we did, I got a lot of heartburn right now, but our job was to go to like the different islands that were around Grenada and set up observation points, surveillance points, right? Basically, we would infiltrate, move a little bit by foot, and then sit down and then, you know, cover up and just watch and listen and then report, you know, any movement of Cubans or PRA, which PRA is PRG. PRA, which was People's Republic Army of Grenada, something like that, PRAG. And so that was our job, report, right? And so we went out one night. My team had a job of going out to an island called Green Island. It wasn't very big. It was about 300 meters by 100 meters, right? And it had a big peak in the middle of it, and like a pinnacle. And it was all jungle at the base. So we infiltrate. We take off and go into the jungle area. We sit down and our job is to sit on the island and watch it. Well, probably about a week earlier, we had another team out there, and actually some PRA had taken a small boat and had come out to the island to recover a cache. And our guys, two of our guys ran out there, it was dark, went out there to intercept it to see who was coming on board. And what happened was, by the time our guys got out there, the element that had landed, the bad guys, had already set up left and right security, and our guys ran right into their left security. And a point blank range got freaking shot up, right? So they had a contact, firefight ensued. Basically, the next day they found a couple of bodies floating in the ocean that belonged to the PRA guys that had been shot from our guys, right? But we took two casualties off of that. And we went back out there again to do the same thing, right? Knowing that they might come back out trying to recover weapons caches and things like that. So I think we spent maybe, four or five days out there, literally sitting on your ass. And if you don't know what it's like sitting on palm fronds for 24/7, especially when you're sweating and you have a sunburn on your ass because you've been out skinny dipping on the beach at the embassy during your off time with the guys, that sucks, man. And you can't move around. You can't stand up and walk around. You're trying to be clandestine. And I remember sitting there every night, man, you can hear the crabs coming, right? Freaking crabs everywhere, man. You can hear them, you know, crawling along the palm fronds and creaking and making noise in the leaves and shit. So all night long, it's like sitting on pins and needles, like literally, you know, your ass is stinging, you hear little crabs and shit, you know, and then you're waiting for the bad guys to show up again so you can have a fight. I remember this one particular night, we're sitting there, and this AH-64 attack helicopter was flying around, and I guess he assumed nobody's on this island, and what he wanted to do is a gun run on this peak, right, this little pinnacle. And fire some rockets and as many guns and just, you know, whatever, have some shits and giggles and not realizing we're sitting there. And so we're kind of watching him, you know, and he goes out, you know, orbits out a little bit and he gets some altitude. He turns around and then also we hear him coming down. We can hear the blades just wop, 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 wop. So we know he's coming in fast and hard. And it occurred to us what he's getting ready to do. Like, oh shit, he's, either he identified us as bad guys, or we figured he's just gonna, you know, let loose on the island for whatever reason. So we just get up and start running, right? And we run right to the edge of the cliff, and we're like, we got nowhere to go. And we just start throwing strobe lights and, you know, flares and shit everywhere, you know. And he does open up, but not onto us. And then he vectors off, you know, after he realized, oh shit, there's people on this freaking island. So, you know, that was one of those, you know, no shit moments for us there for a minute. But it was an interesting experience. You know, it was my first deployment ever, you know, you want to call it a combat deployment. And, you know, we did a lot of other missions out there, you know, doing different things. But it was cool, but it was not, you know, it wasn't like, you know, the movie Platoon, where every day you're out there and it's like, you know, firefighting, it's game on. By that time, you know, the PRA and the Cubans didn't put up much of a fight after that. You know, they were pretty much squashed immediately. So that was my experience there in the 82nd, the 82nd LRPS. You know, all said and done, you know, it was a good experience. You know, it was a little bit better just being an infantryman. We were a little bit more elite, a little bit more coddled, if you will. We got a little bit cooler gear, better high-speed communications equipment, stuff like that. We needed that. So we got, you know, some other good stuff, but it made it worth it, right? But it still wasn't enough for me. One other thing I wanted to point out, and I think I was telling a friend of mine this recently about being in my experience in the 82nd. And again, to put this in perspective for anybody that's out there listening, that's never been in the military, I want you to fathom this. So by the time I was 21 years old, I had gone through the jump master school, right? Become what we call a master blaster, jump master. I had enough jumps under my belt as a novice jumper to go to school and now earn my master parachute badge and now be the guy that actually puts people out of the aircraft. So what does that mean? So at the age of 21 as a master jump master, and which was not uncommon. In fact, there were a lot of guys my age that were master jump masters, right? That were doing this. But at my age, at 21, my job, my responsibility was to, one, coordinate with the Air Force and coordinate the airborne operations, the jump that we're going to do. I had to know where, you know, the IPs were. I had to know where the point of impact was on the drop zone. I had to calculate all this crap for altitude, all the stuff that would be needed to effectively put my jumpers out of the airplane and make sure they land, you know, on this drop zone. And so that was my job, is to coordinate with them to set that part up. And then my job was to train, not train, but to basically pre-train, I guess, or give refresher training to the entire, I mean, usually it was a battalion, right? I would do a battalion sized jump. So think about that for a minute, 3 to 4 companies, you know, 300 to 400 paratroopers, you know, ranging from the old man, the four-bird colonel, all the way down to first sergeant, sergeant major, and everybody else in the battalion. And my job was to put them in through a pre-jump training where I would take them out and we would actually go through, I would have to refresh them on, you know, jumping procedures, you know, basically what do you do if you have a malfunction? You know, you do this, you do that, you do that, right? It's very sequential and it's completely scripted, right? So you have to memorize this stuff. And you can't miss a beat, man. So it's very, you know, very scripted. And then you actually put them through their jumps, right? Their static jumps, like from a platform that's about 5 feet up. You make them jump off into a sand pit, you know, and practice their rolls and stuff like that. Then once all that's done, then your job is to get everybody down to Pope Air Force Base, and then get them in either the hangars or the parachute shed, and then get them chuted up, right? They all have to put their chutes on, and then they would follow these long lines, and then me and my assistant jump masters, our job was to inspect every jumper, all of his equipment, everything. If he was jumping the rucksack, firearms, or as a M16, everything had to be inspected, and everything was sequential, right? Everything, man. I mean, it's freaking, you got to be on it, man. And jump masters, very hard to get through because they want to make sure that you pay attention to detail and it's time. So they put a lot of stress on you, right? And it's very easy to fail out of jump master school. So if you make it through jump master school, especially in the 82nd, you're doing pretty damn good, right? And so you got to inspect every jumper, man, because ultimately it's your responsibility. If that guy goes on that bird and he's got a chute, a harness, a parachute, a static line, or anything that's, is got a flaw to it, something's wrong with it, and you don't catch it, you're the guy on the blame line. You're going to get your ass reamed, man. It's not a good thing, right? So you're responsible for everything. Then you get everybody on the aircraft. Okay, they're all seated, everything's organized, and then the aircraft finally takes off. And then as a jump master, at some point, you start giving the 20-minute warnings. You hear the pilot say, you got 20 minutes, you tell the jumpers 20 minutes, 10 minutes, right? And it's a countdown, 6 minutes, so, all your jumpers stand up, hook up, check study line, check equipment, right? So you go through all these sequences, right? You're the guy running this shit inside of an airplane, right? You're wobbling around, standing up and getting airsick. And then the jump master or the load master, Air Force load master, looks at you and says, jump master, he says, basically, he's the Army, you have the door, right? Which means I'm now completely in charge. The door opens up. I put the ramp out, and my job is to go out and start spotting for the drop zone, looking for the IPs, the PIP, everything, right? And then basically the countdown begins. Okay, we're like 3 minutes out. Now we're 1 minute out. We're 30 seconds out. Jumper stand in the door and go, right? And then put everybody out of the aircraft. Not just my aircraft, but, there might be 5 or 10 aircraft flying at the same time in this formation, and they're all dumping paratroopers, right? And then when they're all out, I'm the last guy that jumps out, I clear the airplane, I look at the load master, say, Air Force, you got it, door's yours now, and I'm out the bridge. And then my job is done at that point. Once I leave that airplane, it's all over. But imagine that, I'm doing that at the age of 21.
Jesus
that's
Christ.
That's what guys in 82nd do, 21-year-olds, 20-year-olds doing the 82nd as jump masters, and it's very common. Can you imagine your average 20, 21-year-old in college doing some shit like that? Hell no, right? The amount of responsibility is just enormous, man. Anything goes wrong, it's on you, man. Nobody's there to, hey, let me take care of this for you. Let me handle that for you. It's like, jump master, what are you going to do? You're in charge, right? And you're an NCO too? You're really in charge, man. So that's the thing about the military, man. I mean, it will challenge you to levels you can't even imagine.
Yeah.
And so I really recommend the military to anybody, man. If you want to grow up and you want to really learn some responsibility, like real responsibility, because in effect, I'm responsible for the lives of 300, 400, 500 men, man, and women, right? That's my job. This could be a night parachute jump, low altitude, There's so many factors that go into this stuff, but I did it. We all did it like it was no big deal. It's, our daily duties. Huh?
Yeah.
You jump master. Oh, okay. All right. Let me throw a warning order. Okay. I'm operator. Got this. Okay. It's amazing. Right. And then when I look back at it now, I'm like, damn, man, at 20, 21 years old, I'm doing that level of responsibility. And that's just, that's unheard of, man. But that's the life, being in the Army or in the military. It's not just the Army.
Yeah.
All right. So I covered that. And what I want to talk about now is, last time we talked about getting through selection, right? And I gave you the numbers on that. And, it wasn't easy. And one of the things I want to say about selection is, and I don't know if I mentioned in the last episode, but Delta Force selection is the most unique selection course in the world, bar none. When I hear people talk about, SEAL Bloods training, SEAL selection, and Ranger School, and, SF, whatever. All those schools, when you go through those processes, you go through as groups, right? I'm going to use the SEALs. Because everybody's seen the movies with all the SEALs on the beach, kicking up, doing flutter kicks, and, they're sprinkled in sand like, sugar cookies, and it's hard, and they're cold and all this stuff, right? But they're out there as a group, right? And when you work as a group, whether you're working together or not, but when you're in a group, what do? You get motivation, you get energy, you get a lot of empowerment from the others, right? That group absolution. And so you could be kind of weak and still get under the radar because everybody else is kind of covering your ass as you're going through it, right? And so the difference between, for example, them and some of these other schools is in Delta Force selection, it's an individual effort. You go through it on your own. And the whole thing, the stress that you go under is the stress that you put on yourself. Nobody's yelling at you. Nobody's, you know, throwing sand on you, making you do a flutter kicks and swimming around the water till you freeze your nuts off. They're not doing that, right? It actually is quite the opposite. It's a gentleman's course. And the instructors are very stoic. You know, they don't even call you by your name. They assign you, you know, colors and numbers. It's like you have no face, no personality. You're just a, you know, carbon-based bipedal, you know, freaking, you know,
yeah,
you know, piece of meat. And so, and the instructions are very concise. They're not very detailed. They basically tell you what the task is. And then when you sit there, you go, well, how much time do I have? Or whatever that, it's like, do the best you can. And they just keep repeating the task. But they never give you the details. They want you to figure it out. And they want you to do the best you can. What does that mean? That means we're not going to tell you what the standard is. You just do the best you can. And if, you know, and if it's not good enough, it's not good enough. You don't make it, you know. But if you do the best you can, maybe it's good enough, maybe it's not. So think about the stress that imposes, yeah. Right? If you do it day in and day out, you're like, you know, day and night, all temperatures, all conditions, you're getting smoked, man. I mean, smoked. I mean, you're physically just deteriorating every day. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And you're just getting this very succinct, straight fuck instructions, right? From a guy with a straight face who never smiles or gets angry. He's not yelling at you. He's not encouraging. He's like a robot. And you're like, fuck, do the best you can. What is that? You know? Yeah. And so you think you do the best you can. And what happens if you really do the best you can, you beat your own ass, right? You're beating yourself down because you don't know what's the minimum time, what's the minimum standard. How much further do I got to go? Am I going fast enough? Am I going far enough? You know, you don't know. The only way you'll know is do the best you can. And you either arrive or you don't, right? And that fucks people's heads up. And I'd be lying if I said it didn't screw my head up. I can remember on the last day, second last day, standing in a field of mud up to my knees, and it's foggy, it's raining. I can't see more than 100 meters. I don't even have a real map. I've got a sketch map that I drew out. I have no idea where the hell I'm at, right? And I don't even know how far I've got to go to get to the next objective, you know. And I don't even know if it's going to end there, you know. I don't have no idea how much more longer this madness is going to go on, but. I'm standing there and my legs felt like each one had 100 pounds attached to it with mud, right? Up to its knees. And I couldn't move. I was so freaking tired. And I just started sobbing, man. I just, you know. And I remember telling myself, if a truck shows up right now, I'm quitting. I'm done, right? But no truck showed up. And then I realized nobody's going to come and get me out in this field, right? Because it's raining, there's fog, and can't see me. And I thought, the only way I'm going to get out of this is I'm going to have to self-recover myself, right? I'm going to have to get out of this myself. And the only way I'm going to be able to quit is if I find the next RV, which, all have, by the way, is on top of a mountain, because that's what my sketch map said. So I got to go up a damn mountain to get to the top. And then when I get there, I can, you know, I can tell the sergeant, sorry, I voluntarily withdraw because I'm a sissy. And so I finally get out, and I'm looking forward to getting to the top so I can quit, and because I'm just done. And I get to the top, and then reason set in, right? It's like, I made it this far. I made it up to the top. Why would I quit now? Because it's downhill, you know? And so I rationalized it, and I thought about it. I was like, no, don't quit, man. Don't quit. You're on the top right now. You're going down, right? You can roll down the hill if you have to, but don't quit. So I talked myself out. I got my next RV, and then went down the hill and continued to move on. And so I look at that day and I'm like, I literally was mentally, psychologically, physically at zero, man. I was wiped out, man. I thought I had nothing left in the gas tank. And I reached really, 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 really deep just to get those feet moving again up that side of that, that mountain to that next RV. So it taught me a lot that day. But to give you an idea, think about that every day. For days, weeks on end, right? And you don't know where's the finish line, how far you gotta go, how fast you gotta go, what else they're gonna throw at you. Nobody's talking to you, nobody's smiling at you, nobody's yelling at you. You know, at least if they're yelling at you, that means they still think you have potential, but they're not even yelling at you, man. So it's like, shit, man. You know, it's like I'm like in some kind of weird freaking science fiction movie, yeah. Right? And so, so anyway, got through all that, and I was fortunate because when it was all over, I think I mentioned last time, there were 110 candidates that started, six finished, and three of us were selected. So think about that. And that happens twice a year, right? And sometimes one guy, maybe two guys get selected, maybe, right? It's the numbers are really, really small from the entire military. Actually, at the time, it was the entire Army. Now it's the entire military. So the numbers are really, really small. So they're looking for that one guy or those two or three guys that have something that they don't tell you what that trait is. We have no idea what they're looking for, right? You know, I was told by some people that they're not looking for the best guy. They're looking for the right guy. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? You know, what's the right guy? And nobody knows, right? But it's one of the best kept secrets in the military. In fact, the whole selection corps standard is the best kept secret in the military. Not compromised. Nobody knows what's the standard of performance, nor do they know what they're looking for in an operator. So I make it through OTC. I go through OTC. It's over 6 months. I won't go into all the details what happens there, just so I mind security, but operation security. But suffice it to say this, OTC is still the selection process. Just because you show up and you're going through training doesn't mean you're in. In fact, that was the first thing that was told to us from a guy, we call him Mad Max. Little short Vietnam Special Forces LERP guy. He was short, too. He was a little dude, man. Big, bushy, red mustache, you know, and just a gnarly, mean little guy, man. But I say he was mean. He was hard, but he was fair. And really all I cared about was making sure that we were trained and that we could survive in the future, right? So he cared about us. But that didn't mean he coddled us, right? And it was tough love, and I appreciate that. And so the first thing he said to us, he goes, "All right, gentlemen," and we all had these badges, right? Issued us badges to get through the gates in the front. Tight security. He goes, "Look at your badges. You know what those badges mean? Does that mean shit? It just means you can walk in and out of the front gate without getting harassed. But it doesn't mean anything else. It doesn't mean you're in. You don't have any kind of special privileges. You're here for training." And like, damn it. Right? And so training went on and selection goes on. And so a lot of guys don't make the OTC program because, again, the stress is piled on top of you. With some of the training that we had to do, it's the most realistic training you'll ever can imagine, right? Everything's live bullets. It's no joke, man. And people get shot all the time in OTC or blown up or both. You know, things happen because the training is always so realistic. And it's not because we're careless, you know, or anything like that. It's just when you train for real, real things happen, right? And so, and then not only that, that freaks people out. And they're like, they can't cope. They can't assimilate fast enough and make decisions fast enough, at least fast enough to where they can safely complete the course or safely complete the task. And in the instructor's minds and even in the peer group's mind, they're not safe enough to do a real operation downrange. It's probably not a guy we want with us, right? He just cannot, you know, adjust fast enough. And so that guy will find himself, you know, doing the duffel bag drag out the front gate. And there's a lot of things that'll get you canned. So it's no cakewalk whatsoever. So I wanted to go into my story, what happened to me. And, you know, in the previous episodes, we talked about autogenic conditioning and what happened to me playing baseball, a lesson I learned playing baseball. And, it was a life lesson that I never forgot. And literally, I went from being the worst baseball player on the planet Earth to the best catcher overnight in the whole league, right? Winning the MVP and on, literally overnight. I went from zero to hero overnight. And I stayed at the hero status after that because of something I had figured out on my own about learning about autogenic conditioning, visualization, some other things, and it saved the day for me, right? So I never forgot that lesson learned. I didn't know it was a thing. I didn't know it had a name. I just know it happened to me. So now I'm in OTC, right? So without getting into all the gritty details and breaking OPSEC or anything like that, what happened was there's a huge emphasis on firearms training. Huge emphasis. Why not? Because Delta Force operators are considered some of the top combat marksmen in the world, right? You have to be a surgical shooter, especially during that era. We were really focused on aircraft hijackings and being able to go take down an aircraft, get inside, and shoot terrorists in the face, right? Throughout the tubular target with freaking hostages hopping around and heads bobbing and taking 10% shots and taking dudes out, you know, at 10, 15, 20 feet or longer, right? In tight, very tight quarters. Not only that, you got to get in the aircraft to start with just to get in and mix it up with these guys, right? So you had to be a good shot. You didn't get a second chance, man. You damn sure couldn't afford to miss and hit a passenger, right? That would have been a bad thing. So there was a lot of emphasis put on marksmanship, and a lot of the marksmanship skills that you see today in all the services, okay, have their genesis in Delta, hands down. But oh, what about the SEALs? No, actually, the SEALs, especially the Black SEALs, started out under us. We gave them the nudge to move forward and help them along. And I won't go into any more than that. But initially what we did was we spent the first month just shooting 45s. And literally 45s. The theory was if you can learn how to shoot a 45, just iron sights, trigger press, you know, front side picture, front side alignment, you know, all those things, then you should be able to pick up any weapon and shoot it proficiently, right? That was the logic. And it makes good sense, right? Because it's teaching you fundamentals. And what better gun to learn on like a 45? It's got a lot of recoil. You know, it's a man's gun. It's got a lot of controls on it that you have to manipulate. So the first 2 weeks was nothing but dry fire, literally just dry fire. We would come in at 8 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night, 7 o'clock at night, minus a lunch and dinner break. And all we would do is stand inside of a bay with little square pasties on the wall, about 1 inch by 1 inch. And we would sit there and full draws from the holster, malfunction drills, all kinds of remedial drills, reload drills. I can go on and on, right? There's a lot that goes into combat marksmanship that people don't really realize, right? Including the four-stroke draw. When do you, take the selector switch off? When do you put your finger on the trigger? When do you take the slack out? Where do you pick up the front sight? Where do you pick up the rear sight? Where do you align the sights? Breathing. I mean, it's martial arts in its deadliest form, literally. And I tell you what, there was no room for, inconsistencies or errors. There's a lot of emphasis put on form. Form had to be perfect. Every shot, everything draw out of the holster, everything you did, the form had to be perfect, right? Form facilitates function. Good form facilitates good function, right? If you have sloppy form, you're going to have sloppy function, man. And that's why you practice karate. You use katas and forms. It's to build that muscle memory and to learn how to, to create, do the right dynamics in the right form so that when you are in a fight, that muscle memory sets in and, you do what you were trained to do. Mm-hmm. So we're up there, we're doing the dry firing every day. And then you got this guy called Mad Max screaming your fucking ear all day, right? He looks like Yosemite Sam. He's putting a boot on your ass all day long. There's other instructors there. They're up and down. They're trooping the lines. And you're like, God damn, hoping to God you're doing it perfect because you don't want to get yelled at in front of everybody. So there's a lot of pressure, man, on you, right? It was not a gentleman's course either. It was not, hey, good job there, Dale. All right, keep doing that. You look good, man. It was like, what the fuck are you doing? And they were just mauling you. Like, But it was like that for a reason, right? Yeah. And you got to learn how to perform under stress, man. And so... Anyways, what happened was, and then every day when we got done, we would go into the classroom And the instructors were always out there with a camera, right? A video camera. They were always filming and stuff, you know. They call it the one I judged on why. So then we go into the classroom, and then they would critique us, you know, by the day's training. You know, well, today this, blah, blah, blah. You know, some of you guys need to work on this. Hey, you over there, you need to really work on that. And you know, I didn't do that. No, you did do that. Look at the one I camera, don't lie, right? When I judge online, they show the video of you all fucked up. Like, okay, I guess I did fuck that up. You know, that happened every day. And I never really got critiqued, ever. You know, nobody ever said anything to me. So I felt like I'm doing pretty good. And it's, you know, I don't know how much time went by. A week went by, 10 days went by. And one day, something happened that never happened before. And we're all sitting in the classroom, you know, waiting for our, you know, we call it hot wash, you know, after action review, critique of the day, before we get cut loose and go home. And first thing Max does is says, Topswatch, stand up. I'm like, whoa, that's never happened before. He's never told anybody to stand up, especially me. And I like, okay, and I stand up, you know, and I'm not sure why I'm standing up, what's going to happen here, but he told me to stand up. And so then he just takes off and just starts chewing my ass. Basically, he says things like, you know, you're the worst student in the classroom. You're all fucked up. If you don't get your shit in one bag, you'll be doing a duffel bag drag out the front gate in a couple of days. What do you think this is? Like some kind of daycare joke? Blah, 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 blah. And then he's just dressing me down in front of everybody. And everybody's looking at me like, ooh, shit, you know? And I'm like, ooh, shit, you know? Yeah. my shoulders are going down. My head's going down. I go, damn, is this really happening? It was bad, right? I mean, he's really laying into me hard in front of everybody. And to the point where I was almost getting mad. I was like, why is he talking to me like this in front of everybody? That's not cool, man. If I'm fucked up, tell me I'm fucked up out there, you know, when we're training, but don't wait till the end of the day to freaking chew my ass out in front of everybody. So there was something wrong with this picture, man, and I didn't understand it, but it scared me, and it scared me bad. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm right on the precipice of getting booted out of OTC. All the hard work, everything I put into this thing for the last year to get here is about to vanish because for some reason I'm not keeping up with the class, even though I thought I was doing well. So that shook me up. I go home and I remember my wife at the time, one of my ex-wives. So she's, you know, she's cooking dinner and I walk in and I'm pretty beleaguered at this point. I said, honey, I'm cooking dinner. Are you ready to eat? And I'm like, no. I said, I'm going straight to bed. She's like, what? I'm going to bed. I got to train. And she looked at me like, what are you talking? I said, don't ask. And she knew. She knew, leave him alone. Don't say shit. Just let him go. And she did. And I went to bed. I literally went to bed because I remembered what I did when I was playing baseball, right? What happened to me there. That whole thing, I thought about it. I said, if I could do that then, maybe I can do that again now.
Yeah.
Right? So I went to bed and I did exactly what I did before, right? I put the music in my ears. I got relaxed. At this point, I took my shower and I was just relaxed. And I laid in my bed there for hours and for hours and hours and hours with my eyes closed. I visualized, you know, drawing that weapon. I could feel that gun in my hand. I could feel all of it in my hand, the stippling, the weight of the gun, the light coat of oil on it. I could feel the trigger press. And I had two of them. I had two 45s. They were set up just a little bit differently, right? The sights were just a little bit different. Everything was just a little bit different, right? And but I can still feel both those guns today, like I just picked them up. I can still feel those guns. They became a part of my body, man. I can still feel the weight and everything of those guns to this day. That's how many times I picked that gun up and fired it. So I remember, you know, feeling the gun. I remember visualizing, you know, bringing the weapon up from 3 to 4, picking the front sight, aligning the rear side alignment, weapons going out, taking slack out of the trigger stop, boom, take that shot, follow through, recover 3, and then back to the holster, you know, malfunction drills, combat reloads, tactical reloads, you know, all this was going through my mind over and over. I did all these mental rehearsals like it was really happening, and when I was doing it, I felt the gun the whole time in my hands, the weight of the magazines, everything, man, pull the slide back, you know, felt the, you know, the pressure on the springs. I did that over and over and over. And then I saw that bullet coming out of that gun and going into the X every time, right? That was all part of the technique. All night long, I did that over and over and over and over. And I just fell asleep. So the next day I go to school, OTC, and the training begins like as usual, you know, 0800 out in the Bay Area, you know, freaking drawing and, you know, ad nauseum doing this training. And day one, nothing happens. Nobody's yelling at me. Nobody's praising me. Crickets. Day two goes by. Nothing's happening. Nobody's yelling at me. Nobody's praising me. More crickets. And then day three goes by. Nothing's happening. Nobody's yelling at me. Nobody's praising me. And I'm thinking, Christ Jiminy, either say something like attaboy or at least yell at me and make me believe I still have potential. But this, the silence was killing me, right? And I'm like, you know, thinking that this is it, man. You know, I'm probably, it's over, man. They've given up on me. That's why they're not talking to me, right? And so after the end of day three, we go back into the classroom and we're going to do another hot wash. And this is the second time this happens. Comstock, stand up. Right off the bat, Comstock, stand up. And I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I mean, oh, my heart was heavy. You know, I couldn't even get the strength to get my ass out of that fucking chair. And I remember thinking, damn, is this my swan song? Is this it? And I stood up, shoulders down, head was low. I didn't even look at the guy. I couldn't even look at him. I couldn't look at my peers. They're all looking at me like, I know what they're thinking. Like, oh, poor guy, you know? And, you know... It was just a bad, I just had a really bad feeling like this is it, you know, he's gonna shoot to my ass again and then basically tell me get my shit and get the hell out of here, right? And I felt so, oh my God, man, I had so much weight on my shoulder. So I stood there and then the next words out of his mouth were, everybody take a look at that man. Everybody take a look at him. And I remember thinking to myself, that's right. Go ahead, look at me. Go ahead, look at the loser. You know, and I'm like, now I'm getting mad, right? Like rebellious. Like, so what? You know, that's what I wanted to say. Even though I'm just kind of standing with my head down, that's what I'm thinking. You know, go ahead, rub it in, you know, assholes. And because I want everybody to take a good look at this man. He goes, I predict this man will be the top gun shooter. You know, he goes, this man is the most fundamentally sound student in the class, and I predict he'll be the top gun shooter at the end of the course. He goes, you guys need to look at this guy. This guy is the best of the best, right? And he's just, I mean, like praising the shit out of me, like total 180. And I'm like, my head's coming up. I'm looking at him like, what? He's like, you're talking about me? And he actually, that's what he said. He said I was the most fundamentally sound student in the class. And his prediction was I would be the top gun shooter at the end when we had the competition. Because at the end, you have a top gun shootout on to see who's the best shooter in the class, right? And so... suddenly, man, my confidence was renewed and like, wow. But what was really amazing is how I flipped this whole script in a matter of 3 days, maybe in one day. I don't know. I might have been on the ball the day after, but it took 3 days for him to get up and you know, sing me praises. Probably because it took him 3 days to watch me and go, what the fuck? Is this guy really improving? He probably couldn't believe it either, right? He's like, let me watch him for another day to make sure. Let me just walk him. Well, let me watch him one more day because I can't believe this, right? And so, but yeah, so that's what happened. And then in the end, so sure enough, right, we at the end of the course, of the firearms portion, we had our shootouts, right? So we did with MP5s, and then the big one was the 45s. And it was double elimination. But basically, to make a long story short, it came down to me and one of the guys. Some of you guys may have heard of this guy named Paul Howe. He was in my OTC class. Now, Paul was a great shot. I can't take nothing from the guy. He was a really good shot, consistent. And he didn't catch no shit in OTC like I did. Nobody messed with him. But it came down to me and him. And he actually beat me, but he only beat me not because he was better than me. He beat me because of something that happened. What happened was we had – both of us had a bank of targets arrayed in front of us, right? We call popping – pepper poppers, falling, you know, silhouettes, steel plates, bowling pins. And then you had in the center between the two, you know, the two banks, you, in the middle, you had what it's called a dueling tree. It's one tree. It's just basically a metal rod. Mm. And it's got two flags on each side. And once you shoot all your, knock all your targets down, You have to knock all your targets down first before you go to the dueling tree. Once you go to the dueling tree, your job was to shoot your two flags and make a swing around to the other guy's side, and then that would declare the winner. And but you could not move on from your target until it fell over, right? So I'm way ahead of him. I'm at least 1 to 2 bullets ahead of him on the shots, right? I get to my last silhouette, my last pepper popper. I shoot his center mass, and it starts to fall over, and it just teeters. It looks like it's not going to go down. And I'm already – I know it's a clean shot, and I'm already on the dueling tree. And as I'm getting ready to shoot the dueling tree, I notice that pepper popper hasn't fallen. I'm like, shit. And so I go back to get it, and just as I go back to get it, it falls over. So now I got to come back onto the tree, and Paul's on it. He's already on the first flag. He knocks one over mine, I knock one over his, and yeah. He beat me by one flag. So, you know, if you want to get technical, I beat him. But but because of the rules, that one damn pepper popper, you know, I took, you know, second place. And I actually didn't mind. I'm like, you know what?
Yeah.
At least I'm here second place, and I'm not doing the duffel bag drag out the front gate, right? Yeah, so I didn't even care, right? I didn't even complain. I was like, you know, that's how it goes. And but I'm here, and I proved myself, and everybody knows – you know, I was a man.
Yeah.
So, but that only happened because of this autogenic conditioning, right? That I've talked about several times now. And what happened to me in playing baseball, and suddenly I did it again, right? And I did it under one of the most stressful situations you can imagine, right? This was, my life was in it, hanging the balance on the same. I'm like, I cannot afford not to be here. I don't want to go to an infantry unit on Fort Polk, Louisiana. This would be so disruptive. Not only that, but for my morale, man, my psyche.
Yeah.
You know, I would feel defeated, and just no way, man. This would not be a good thing for me, you know? And so, but now, you know, it worked, and I made it all the way through. And I remember towards the end of the course, you know, we had another board that we had to sit in front of, right? Another commander's sergeant's major board. And they wanted to make sure that we were the right guy before he sent us over the hall. And, you know, I got the blessing. Okay, you're good enough, Comstock. Even though you're the youngest guy we've ever selected at 23, you're good enough. I go across the hall and I report to my sergeant major, and I'll forget my sergeant major, Jack, right? He's like, congratulations, man. Okay, well, welcome to the squadron, you know, blah, 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 blah. He goes, but I have to remind you, he goes, selection's a continuous process. And if you're not giving us 110% every day, we can't use you. You're out of here, right? I'm like, damn, man. So, and it's true, man. If you're not putting out, you're just, you know, you're useless, man. So, selection really is a continuous process, man. There's no time, there's no, you know, there's no room for a guy to start sliding backwards, you know, and it's just not, they don't need that. And they don't need you. They need every guy to be running 110% every day, right? And so, and the work, you know, the job, being that, in that unit, was probably one of the most motivating jobs ever. I look forward to going to work every morning. Man, I can't wait for today. What are we going to do today? It's going to be cool stuff, you know? And then coming home at night, it's like, man, it was like a great day. It was satisfying, you know? You felt like you got something done, you know? Not just for yourself, but for America, for the Army, you know? It's like, you know, I put it out there today, man, again, you know? And again and again and again. A very satisfying experience. And, you know, so that was, you know, a little bit about my time in the unit, getting there to the unit, and then how did I get there? It was not wasn't a cakewalk, as you can, it is, you know, you can tell from what the story I was telling you. It was actually harder for a lot of other guys, even in OTC, it was like a nightmare for them. Mm-hmm. You know, but it is what it is. You know, they don't always pick the best guy; they pick the right guy. You know, because being best is relative. They know what the right guy is though, right? And so so that's, you know, that's my story, man, this time. And you know, in the book, it's called Top Gun. That chapter is Top Gun, talks about a little bit about that. And then you know, I talked a little bit about the selection process. And then next time I'm going to talk about going through Special Forces qualification course to be a Green Beret. So I went through that school while I was in Delta to also become a Green Beret, a light and heavy weapons expert. So that's got some funny shit in it, some things that happened to me. Again, my life, I don't know why, but my life can't ever be easy, right? I can't just do something normal like everybody else. So I'll give you a little synopsis of what happened before, right? A little trailer. So I go through the Q course and I'm going through a divorce. Don't even know I'm going through a divorce yet, because as I'm going through the Q course, my ex-wife is having an affair. And then I find out, you know, as I start the course, I'm a few weeks into it. And that just turned into, a circus. And then, you know, she left me, took my daughter, left me my son, who was only 18 months old. And so now I'm trying to take care of an 18-month-old boy, find a babysitter at 4:30 in the morning, get through the Q course, which was, you know, those are long ass days, pick him up in the evening, you know, be daddy to him, take care of him, you know, and prepare myself for the next day. So the Q course was like really hard for me. I made it. Here I am. And now my son's a Green Beret. He's a Ranger. Followed my footsteps. So hopefully he's learned something from me growing up. Anyway, so there's my stories, man, for today.
For today, yeah. I was going to say, same time next week. Dale, do you think you can get a how to do the podcast?
I don't know how to get a hold of him. I could try.
Yeah, just try.
He's probably on Facebook. I'm sure he is on social media somewhere. He's in Texas, the last I heard. I'll see if I can't run him down. You know, I'll see if I can't find him. Let me just write that note. That's two guys I'm still running down.
Yeah, please do. That would be fucking awesome. Because there are a lot of people that I found I can get in touch with, but they just don't give a fuck. And it's when I can, like, name drop someone or I have someone else reach out on my behalf. Then all of a sudden it opens the door. So to me, it's just like, who the fuck is this kid? But if it's Comstock saying, like, hey, man, it works out a lot better.
Yeah.
No rush there.
I'll see if I can run him down. He's got a good story, too, man. Yeah, you know, from Mogadishu.
Yeah, yeah. That's where I recognize the name. You know,
yeah, so Paul's a good dude. He's always been a good dude. So anyways, so that kind of wraps it up, I think. Calling from Bali. And the same time, same place next week. We'll do this again. Got a lot more to cover. And it only gets better as it goes along here.
Yeah, it does. So, and for everybody listening, all of this is in his book, American Badass, which will be in the description. Sticking to the top comment. It's on Amazon. You can get it on Kindle. It's not on Audible yet, Dale. You need to get on that. You need to have someone narrate it.
I don't know how to do that, man. I don't want to narrate it because I can't read, man. I can kind of like write, but I can't really read. Kind of weird, right? I wrote the book, but I can't read it.
I can put you in touch with an actual professional Audible narrator.
Yeah?
Yeah, I had a guy on the podcast. Yeah, he does. His name's Noah Levine. He's read like 800 books for Audible. Legitimate professional voice actor.
Okay, yeah, I'd be happy to talk to him, man. Right before this call, I actually had somebody message me, go, hey, is this book in Audible? Because they like to, you know, listen while they're working. So I've gotten that quite a bit. But yeah, appreciate that.
Yeah, I'll make a note right now. I'll have him email you.
What else?
I think that's all of it. So same time next week, 10 a.m. Eastern Time Sunday next week for part 5. And yeah, everyone get the book. I'll put that guy in touch with you. And Dale Comstock, the American Badass. And one day the NSA will release the good episodes. So
after I'm in jail.
Yeah, after we're both in jail and or dead. So but until then, just enjoy this. All right, Dale. See you next week, man.
All right, brother. Be good, man. Take care, everybody.
Peace. God bless America. Stay safe, everybody.